variety of technologies. The government is interested in the variety of the collaborative technologies, such as, but not limited to, inertial mass reduction, mechanical structural metamaterials, electromagnetic metamaterial waveguides, quantum physics, quantum communication, and beamed energy propulsion. Let me drop for a sec. Further down in the document, the government lists material technologies that Two Stars Academy of Arts and Sciences has agreed to provide, hinting that in addition to the metamaterials, Two Stars Academy of Arts and Sciences claims to have performed research on quantum communications and may possess prototypes of beamed energy propulsion vehicles and active camouflage and directed photon projection systems. Other elements of To the Stars Academy of Arts and Sciences' version of the story have come under serious scrutiny, such as their claims about the nature of Department of Defense Advanced Aerospace Threat Identification Program and its findings. The To the Stars Academy of Arts and Sciences scientist studying the supposed metamaterials is a guy called Hal Puthoff. Puthoff has conducted work on paranormal topics, apparently, for the CIA and the Defense Intelligence Agency, such as the debunked remote viewing program. He's also connected to the defunct Skinwalker investigation. At least some of these reports produced for these programs were fringe or downright junk science. So, as you may have noticed, we are living in quite strange times, and they appear to be going even stranger. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS. No comments, but I would once again recommend the men who stared at goats. It's an interesting read. Let me go on to the next story after this drop. The Army isn't the only respected government institution that occasionally falls down a rabbit hole. NASA has done it before with the M-Drive, and they seem to be doing it again. Remember that magical rocket engine I summoned out of unicorn dust last week? The one that could approach velocities near the speed of light? Well, some scientist at NASA has been spending a lot of time thinking about such a magical engine. NASA employee David Burns has recently proposed a concept that he calls a helical engine, which could theoretically reach 99% the speed of light without any propellant. As Burns explains in his paper submitted to the NASA Technical Report Server, the helical, as a spring-shaped engine, would exploit the way mass tends to change at close to relativistic speeds in a vacuum. He says the engine accelerates ions confined in a loop to moderate relativistic speeds and then varies their velocity to make slight changes to their mass. The engine that moves ions back and forth along the direction of travel to produce thrust, explained Burns. With no moving parts other than the ions traveling in a vacuum trapped inside the electric and magnetic fields, the engine is thought by some to show a good deal of promise, at least in theory, but also suffers from a number of not-so-insignificant practical issues. Let me drop for a sec. More specifically, as noted in The New Scientist by John Cartwright, as well as Burns himself, to make it work, the engine would have to be about 656 feet long, 40 feet in diameter, and generate 165 megawatts of energy to produce a single newton of thrust, which corresponds to using a power station to accelerate a kilogram of mass per second squared. While the paper hasn't yet been peer-reviewed and does not contain any specific instructions on how to build such a Star Trek-esque contraption, Burns' ideas have so far been met with mostly positive responses from fellow engineers and scientists who, while far from sure that the engine of this type could possibly work, welcome their colleagues' enthusiasm and bold thinking. Then there are other scientists that suggest that his ideas violate the laws of physics. Burns' own description of his engine seems to get some very important aspects of relativistic effects somewhat wrong. That would suggest that even if he could build such a working device, it would effectively go nowhere very fast. And even if the technology is possible, keep in mind our little puzzler from 2 weeks ago. Depending upon how close to the speed of light your rocket might be capable of getting to, that astronaut might outlive all of humanity by the time he reaches his destination. Still, it's good to dream, getting really outside the box, just as long as you remember where you put that box. Hey, anyone, know where I can get the fresh supply of unicorn dust? Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS. Okay, this particular engine is very reminiscent of the M-Drive. I don't know if it's ever going to get to the point where anyone tries to model it, because somehow you have to get something at near relativistic speeds in order for it to kick in, which I don't think anyone's going to. But I will have links to both the article that demonstrates the principle and a very short article on how this device really violates Newton's third law of motion. On to the next story. Caltech researchers have discovered rare brain cell types that are unique to male mice and other types that are unique to female mice. These sex-specific cells were found in a region of the brain that governs both aggression and mating behaviors. A paper describing the research appeared online on October 17th in the journal Cell. The results show that there are differences between male and female mammalian brains at the level of cellular composition, as well as gene expression, but that those differences are subtle and their functional significance remains to be explained. There are many different types of cells within the brain, such as neurons that transmit signals and glial cells that support neural function. Although all of these cells contain the same set of genes or genomes, the types of cells differ in how they express these genes. As an analogy, one can imagine the genome as an 88-key piano in each cell. Each cell does not use all 88 keys. Therefore, the subset of keys that the cell plays determines the type of cell that it is. The hypothalamus is a fundamental region of the brain found in all vertebrates, including humans. Previous studies have shown that a specific anatomic subdivision in the hypothalamus, called the ventrolateral subdivision of the ventromedial hypothalamus, contains cells that control aggression and mating behavior. In these studies, strong stimulation of these neurons in male and female mice immediately caused the animals to become aggressive, even in the absence of any threat. However, weak stimulation causes the mice to begin mating behaviors. Let me drop for a sec. In this new work, the researchers examined gene expression in individual cells in the previously mentioned subdivision in the brain. This was made possible by advanced transcriptomic techniques that can enumerate and identify the RNA transcripts that a cell contains. This information can be used to classify different cell types. Previous studies were only able to examine 10% of the transcripts in each cell, whereas this study looked at a larger proportion of transcripts. The team discovered that there are 17 different types of brain cells in this very tiny region alone. What's more, an examination of the patterns of gene expression revealed that some of these 17 cell types are more abundant in male mice than in female, while others are found only in females. It was known that different genes are expressed in the two mouses' sexes. Indeed, a genetic test can tell you whether a mouse is male or female, but this is the first discovery of the type of cells that are sex-specific in a mammalian brain. Cells are considered to be distinct types when the expression of large clusters of genes vary from cell to cell. Future work will try to determine the function of these differing cell types. Can we definitely extrapolate these findings to all mammals, including human beings? Well, not yet, but I bet there are some researchers out there who plan on trying to do just that. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS. Okay, the next story is just kind of juxtaposed with the previous one to demonstrate how confusing experimental science can be at times. Often researchers use other species in their search to explain how we all tick. Sometimes that's reasonable, but not always. All living things are usually more similar in many ways than they are different, but that does not mean that we aren't different in many ways. And this next bit of research demonstrates this quite well. An international team of researchers has found that the mouse cerebellum may not be a good model for the human cerebellum in brain studies. In their study published in the journal Science, the group described their comparison studies that involved humans, mice, and macaque cerebellums as they developed. Prior research has suggested that the mouse cerebellum and human cerebellum are enough alike that experiments on the mouse cerebellum can be conducted to learn more about how the human cerebellum works. The cerebellum in humans is the part of our brain that deals with sensory information and the way we respond to it. In this new effort, the researchers sought to find out if the mouse cerebellum truly is enough like the human cerebellum for results from such experiments to be useful. Let me drop for a second. The work by the team involved very closely studying the development of the cerebellum in mice, humans, and macaques, another animal that is used for cerebellum studies. After obtaining human cerebellum tissue samples from hospitals and other institutions, mouse samples from test mice, and images of macaque cerebellum tissue from prior research efforts, the team compared them. They found that they had enough material and data to compare cerebellum development from 30 days post-conception to approximately 9 months after birth. The researchers report that they found a completely unexpected difference. A group of progenitor cells that have never before been seen in the human cerebellum or the brain of either mice or macaques. Until this finding, such cells had been seen only in human cerebral cortex. They also found that some of the progenitor cells in an area called the rhombic lip were the source of cerebellar granule neurons. And they found that the rhombic lip took longer to develop in humans than the other two animals. It continued maturing throughout gestation. That suggests they suggest such clear differences could mean that comparisons of the cerebellum across mice and humans may not be as revealing as had been hoped before. They also note that such differences might explain why it's been so difficult to mimic cerebellum-based human defects in the animal model so far. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS. Okay. Now, for this story, once again, I swear I have not shorted Johnson & Johnson stock, but they just keep showing up on the news these days, and I feel it's always a good idea to tell people about it. Johnson & Johnson announced a voluntary recall of its talc-based baby powder products this past Friday after the Food and Drug Administration found traces of cancer-causing asbestos in sample testing. The recall shows legal losses. The recall follows legal losses and an investigative report linking asbestos exposure to the company's talc products. The recall will affect only one lot of baby powder, which still amounts to up to 33,000 bottles, according to the company. It was prompted by the FDA finding a subtrace level of chrysotile asbestos contamination in a sample taken from a bottle bought online. Another lot tested by the FDA turned up negative. There seems to be no report of injury linked to these products, but in a statement by the company Friday, the company said that the recall was made out of the abundance of caution that they had. The company also added that it has rigorous testing standards in place to ensure its cosmetic talc is safe, and years of testing, including the FDA's own testing on prior occasions, and as recently as last month, found no asbestos. Last December, however, an investigative report by Reuters uncovered evidence showing that the company knew for decades that some of its own independent tests had detected asbestos in its products. Johnson & Johnson also took steps to conceal these results from the public, as well as the FDA, Reuters reported. The company has outright denied these allegations and argued that the overall scientific evidence does not point to a link between talc-based consumer products and cancer. Let me drop. However, there's thought to be no safe level of exposure to asbestos in human beings, and because talc is often mined near sources of asbestos, there's always a risk of cross-contamination. This March, a jury sided with a California woman who argued that she had developed cancer from decades of using Johnson & Johnson baby powder, awarding her $29.4 million. The company also failed to overthrow a $4.69 billion verdict rendered in another case involving 22 women last December. The plaintiffs in these more recent cases, unlike previous attempts to sue the company over its baby products, have explicitly argued that talc-related asbestos could have caused their cancer. In 2018, the FDA embarked on a new fact-finding mission, testing a variety of talc-based cosmetic products for asbestos. While a final report is still pending, the agency has periodically sent public advisories and pushed for recalls of products that contain asbestos. In June, for instance, the cosmetic store Claire announced a recall of products that the FDA had detected asbestos in, while another recall by Beauty Plus Global followed in September. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS.
AC2OGB, comments?
Yes, Greg.
Problem is, you mentioned that they tried to cover up the fact of why they recalled the stuff, but usually the public might already get word of the stuff before they try to conceal it.
It depends. In this case, they didn't conceal it. In previous cases, it was reported that they had successfully hidden it for years. So it's a kind of a mixed message. The problem, unfortunately, is that cross-contamination of talcum powder with asbestos is not incredibly unusual. And asbestos asbestos was all over the place. Before you were born, people were using it for all kinds of things. And when I was a chemistry major, I've told the story more than a few dozen times where I used to saw holes in asbestos pads so that I could put the test tubes through them, and that was all done without a hood, which was kind of foolish in retrospect, but we didn't know better. It would be nice if they didn't hide the problem, and they're going to have to pay for the problem because they made the profit from the product. So it's not a good time to be a Johnson & Johnson stockholder.
Exactly, and because of it, people are now rushing to claim large cash settlements because of it, as you mentioned. That's all for now. Kitty2OGB.
Roy, 2N.
Roy, what is the raw ingredient for talcum powder?
I do not recall what it's a mineral. It's some mined mineral. I could look it up right now and tell you.
Yeah, let's pick up Paul in the meantime. Go ahead, Paul.
Okay, I heard this report on CBS Radio last week, and one of the things that Johnson & Johnson is saying that they're trying to blame the test lab, saying that cross-contamination happened at the lab itself.
N1YDY, I think it's magnesium.
It's basically a clay mineral composed of hydrated magnesium silicate. That's what talc is. But, they mix in cornstarch also. To understand why Johnson & Johnson would want it to be a lab anomaly caused by a problem in the lab as opposed to a mining problem, because that's a much bigger problem to deal with.
If it's a testing lab problem, then the report is a false alarm. Wouldn't Johnson be happy about that?
That would be what they would, in their dream come true, that would solve a lot of problems. That's why I doubt that sincerely, unless they have some very good proof on that. Fortunately, with asbestos, it's sort of the gift that keeps on giving. People exposed to asbestos years earlier can develop secondary cancers from it, and so I don't know how Johnson & Johnson is going to deal with this. I mean, it has deep pockets, thankfully, for itself, but I don't know if they're that deep. Okay, on to the next story. We did a story a couple of months ago about a French safety commission finding that blue LEDs might be injurious to your health. Researchers have been hard at work investigating this claim, at least when it comes to the health of fruit flies. The blue light that emanates from every smartphone and fluorescent bulb isn't thought to be great for our health, particularly the health of our eyes. But a new study in fruit flies suggests that blue light can even be harmful to brains and speed up aging, again in fruit flies. There's a very long way to go before you can assume the same thing is true for actual human beings. Researchers at Oregon State University kept some adult flies in a cycle of 12 hours straight of blue light exposure, then darkness for the next 12 hours. These flies were compared to control groups of flies that either got total darkness for the entire day or bathed in light that had the blue wavelengths blocked. The common fruit fly only lives a few months in best of conditions, but these had gotten the blue light special, had much shorter lives than either control group. Living only half as long, they also showed signs of damage to their retina and brain. They couldn't climb as well. Going one step further, the researchers did the same experiment with flies genetically engineered to be missing their eyes completely. Once again, the flies were bad at climbing and died early, and they had clear signs of brain degeneration. According to the authors, the findings suggest that blue light isn't just capable of damaging the living cells of the retina, but can independently damage the brain as well. And coupled with other animal research showing a similar effect on longevity from artificial light exposure, the authors wrote that the question of possible detrimental effects of light on brain aging in people needs to be studied. Let me drop for a sec. Other studies involving human subjects have found the link between artificial light, which is typically mostly blue light, and poorer health. Such as a greater risk of insomnia or other sleep problems. One way this likely happens is by messing with our internal clock, which historically has only ever had to respond to sunlight. Some studies have also suggested that blue light can cause our skin to prematurely age and wrinkle. But as important as fruit flies are for studying how drugs and other things can affect people, they're not perfect substitutions. These sort of studies are good for generating and testing out theories, but they're far from the last word on anything. Put simply, it's not time to suspect your smartphone is rotting your brain. It might be doing it for completely different reasons. Still, as the researchers point out, people haven't lived in places where blue light is omnipresent for that much time. In many of the world, they still don't. So there's no really telling just how it's affecting our health over the long run. The authors also note that their findings could affect the future of fly research, since the light used in fly facilities may critically affect experimental outcomes. Aging studies using these flies, they added, should report light exposure in order to make sure that the research can be consistent across different labs. So, if you have fruit flies as pets, keep them away from your blue LEDs. As for the rest of your household, the jury isn't quite in on the detrimental effect of blue LED light. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS. Okay, on to the next. Salamanders are renowned for their regenerative capabilities, such as growing back entire limbs. We can't pull off this biological trick ourselves, but new research highlights a previously unknown regenerative ability in humans, one held over from our evolutionary past. Our bodies have retained the capacity to repair injured or overworked cartilage in our joints, say a new research published recently in Science Advances. Remarkably, the mechanics of this healing process are practically the same as what's used by amphibians and other animals to regenerate lost limbs, according to the study. The scientists who identified this previously unknown human capacity are hopeful their findings could lead to powerful new therapies to treat common joint disorders and injuries, including osteoarthritis. More radically, this healing mechanism might be exploited to enhance joint repair and establish a basis for human limb regeneration, the authors wrote in their paper. Some animals, like axolotls, zebrafish, and bichir fish, are capable of regenerating different parts of their bodies. The axolotl is particularly special in that it can regrow its limbs, organs, and even portions of its brain. That humans cannot regrow entire limbs is hardly news to anyone, but scientists previously thought we were likewise incapable of even self-repairing damage and deteriorating cartilage in our joints. To further understand this apparent human limitation, scientists from Duke University Science of Medicine and Lund University sought to determine how long proteins actually last in cartilage. This led to an awareness that the cartilage proteins of the knee were, in general, younger than the proteins of the hip of people of similar age. Virginia Krause, a professor of medicine at DUSM and co-author of the new study, told reporters, by younger, we mean that they had accumulated fewer modifications of their structure that happened naturally over time with aging. This led us to want to evaluate ankle cartilage, and in fact, we found that they're the same proteins who are younger still, she said, adding that nothing like this had been observed before. Let me drop for a second. This previously unknown capacity was discovered using proteomics, whereby scientists can investigate thousands of proteins at once using small samples. This led Krause and her colleagues to learn that the age of cartilage proteins could be correlated to the body part in which they resided. The cartilage proteins, including collagen and ankles, were young. In knees, they were middle-aged, and in hips, they were old. This is a remarkable finding in that a similar phenomenon is seen in animals capable of limb regeneration, as tissue repair tends to be more productive in the distal portions of their extremities. That's the tips of feet and tails and such, the end parts. Interesting, this could explain why in humans the hips and knees require more time to heal than ankles and why ankles are less susceptible to severe arthritis. Hips are twice as likely to need joint replacement, and evidence also exists showing that ankles with osteoarthritis are rarely do progress to a severe state of the disease. This regenerative process is regulated by a molecule known as microRNA. This molecule has proven to be very useful over the course of evolution, appearing in many types of animals. A microRNA controls large sets of critical genes for tissue regeneration, and it's more active in animals with the capacity to regenerate entire limbs. MicroRNA is also present in humans, a genetic holdover from our evolutionary past. We no longer use it to regenerate limbs, but it does help fix our damaged cartilage, according to this research. As the scientists demonstrate in the new paper, the activity of microRNA depends upon its location in the body, with heightened activity in ankles compared to knees and hips. Quote, we are excited to learn that the regulators of regeneration in the salamander limb appear to also be the controllers of joint tissue repair in the human limb, said Ming-Fang Zhai, a DUSM molecular physiologist and the first author of the paper, in a press release. We call it our inner salamander capacity. Let me drop for a sec. Krause said that she is very hopeful that these findings will be translated to actual therapies in the near future. Because microRNA are very druggable, they could be injected directly into a joint to boost repair to prevent osteoarthritis after a joint injury, or even slow or reverse osteoarthritis once it has developed, she said. And as the authors noted in the paper, microRNA, along with other yet-to-be-identified compounds, could lead future use of a molecular cocktail for attempted limb regeneration in humans. Randall Voss, a biologist from the University of Kentucky and an expert on regenerative abilities of axolotl, said that the new paper represents some very interesting data about protein turnover and microRNA expression, pointing to an underlying repair mechanism in humans. Voss, also not involved with this new paper, said that the proposed repair response in humans is vastly different than the repair method used by salamanders and other creatures to regenerate cartilage wholesale and damaged joints. The link to microRNA in both cases is interesting, he said, but we still have much to learn about the requirements of microRNA in tissue repair in humans and regeneration in salamanders, adding that functional studies are needed to move these findings forward. Let me drop for a sec. It is amazing to find that although we humans have separated from the axolotl 400 million years ago in evolution, there are many pathways that are commonly shared between human and axolotl. Although we still have a long way to go to explain why humans cannot regenerate, this study provides compelling evidence that there are many similarities in human and salamander limbs. Looking ahead, these findings will motivate researchers to focus on the distal portion of the animal, at the far end, to determine why these parts regenerate better than the proximal positions, that's the ones closer to your trunk. A big question moving forward is whether the distal environment is more permissive for tissue regeneration, or distal cells are more capable of regeneration, or maybe both. These and other questions will hopefully one day be answered, whether we can promote tissue regeneration in the human body. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
So why don't they get some of this micro-RNA, wherever they're going to get it from, and inject it into some volunteer somewhere? I'm sure there's plenty of people with, you know, bad enough bones that would go along with it and see what happens.
Well, maybe some guy who doesn't mind getting stuck with house arrest in China will try that. You got to be very, very cautious with human experimentation. Nothing is proved, and people tend to be very conservative to try untried techniques on human beings. So they're going to be doing a lot of research in other animal models before they start injecting microRNA into human beings. Now, probably there's going to be some little shack in Mexico with a guy who says he's a doctor who says he's going to be injecting microRNA next week, because that's just the nature of things. But I would be sort of amazed if human studies will progress within the next 5 years. It's just not the way research works.
Okay. I always think of that guy that gave himself the ulcer to prove a point. Yeah. I think he was a doctor, right?
Memory serves me right. He might have been a veterinarian, because I remember he wasn't quite a doctor, but he was really close to a doctor. So I think the story was that he was a veterinarian. And I guess if you do it to yourself, you're not going to sue you. And as long as you survive, and if you didn't survive, what would they arrest you for, killing yourself? So I'm not quite sure. But it's not really good medicine. I mean, it makes for a great story at cocktail parties and such. But thankfully, the overall majority of research scientists do not self-experiment. This kind of mostly is seen in bad Victorian horror novels, you know, like Mr. Heckle, Dr. Heckle, Heckle and Jai, Hyde and Jekyll, yeah, things like that. So not the best idea to do it. Some guys have done it out of desperation because they really believed in themselves, and the ones who survived were right.
Okay, very good. Yeah, I could just see somebody doing it, though. You know, like you said, in some foreign country. Yeah, you know, people are going to get impatient, you know, if they think it's 5 or 10 years down the road. That might be too long.
Oh, I mean, that's unfortunately the problem with stem cells. Stem cells have a great deal of promise that hasn't been particularly proven yet, and that have side effects that haven't really been fully evaluated. But that doesn't stop people of dubious, professional, degrees setting up a little practice someplace and injecting stem cells into all kinds of things. And sometimes that wreaks havoc. We've done more than a few stories of the FDA shutting down little clinics that are injecting random stem cells into people. So I would not be at all surprised to find out if, say, 6 months from now, there's some little place down in Mexico giving micro-RNA injections.
Okay, very good. I'll let you continue on. This is WN2N, by the way.
Hey, very good, Paul. My next story, the Russian Federation is going through some tough times. Now they seem to have a walrus gap, or perhaps they would like to have a greater walrus gap. A walrus attacked and sunk a Russian naval boat with scientists and media on board just a few weeks ago, according to a Russian Geographical Society press release. All of the group's participants were safely brought to shore and no walruses were harmed. The vessel was carrying researchers to Franz Josef Land, a Russian archipelago far above the Arctic Circle, whose only human residents are military personnel. The trip stopped by various locales previously visited by 19th century Arctic explorers, and its participants studied the glaciers as well as the plants and animals present on the islands. smaller boats brought a participant between a main vessel and the islands. It was one of those crafts that a mother walrus reportedly attacked and sank, perhaps because she felt her cub was being threatened at the time. Walruses are large, tusked marine mammals in the same pinniped clade as seals and sea lions. They inhabit icy Arctic waters and can weigh over a ton. Walrus attacks on humans and their vessels are not uncommon, according to Lori Quackenbush, a biologist from the Alaska Department of Fish and Game's Arctic Marine Mammal Program. Quote, "We have to be very careful doing research not to get surrounded by ice and walruses without an escape route. Calves are curious and will approach a boat, which makes the mother aggressive to defend the calf," Quackenbush told reporters. Groups of young males can also be aggressive and dangerous to small boats. Quackenbush explained that walrus hunters have encountered walrus puncturing skin boats and their tusks, or even flipping over aluminum boats. I wonder if DARPA is working on walruses with laser beams attached. Anyway, let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS. Hey, hopefully my next one will get some kind of a comment out of Paul about it. Last August, the orbital module of one of the Soyuz spacecraft used to ferry astronauts and cosmonauts to and from the International Space Station was discovered to have a small hole. This hole was an issue as it was causing an alarming leak of breathable air inside the ISS into space. The hole appeared to be a human-made drill hole, not anything like an asteroid strike. It now seems that the Russian agency, Roscosmos, knows why that hole was there, but they're refusing to tell NASA for no good reason, as far as anyone can tell. Well, they did provide one hint, but it's really not a good one. They said, there must be some secret with us. And that was their line. That's what the head of Roscosmos, Dmitry Rogozin, told participants at an all-Russian science conference called Orbit of Youth. The hole was made in the orbital module of Soyuz, a spherical-shaped module at the top of the spacecraft that is used for on-orbit living space docking and can be used as an airlock in a pinch. The orbital module is one of the most innovative parts of the Soyuz design, allowing for more living space without a substantial weight increase. It also tends to work best when free of holes, and it's pretty baffling why Roscosmos would choose to keep the reason why one made it to space with a hole a secret. They are embarrassed. Are they embarrassed at the manufacturing mistake? Are they covering up sabotage? Did an accident happen at orbit? We wouldn't have to wildly speculate if they just tell someone, you know? Where's that Russian Federation transparency that we all love about them? Anyway, let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
Yeah, their administrator for Roscosmos has got Dmitry Roscosmos, I forget his name, but he, ever since he took over, it's been a problem. He's been involved with the space program for a while, and he was the guy that, you know, when this whole problem with the Russian engines and the American engines, you know, we don't want to use their engines anymore, and he was going to just cut us off altogether. He's the one that told us that, to get to the International Space Station, you'll have to use it. The Americans will have to use a trampoline. You know, bit of a wise guy, and he's no bargain. But Putin put him in charge of Roscosmos, which is like their NASA. So, you know, I mean, there's sanctions against this guy. I mean, according to the laws, he's not even allowed in our country. It's nothing but a problem. So I'm not surprised he's not telling anybody. If he knows who did it, no big surprise there.
Oh, what can you do? Some people you just can't be friends with, I guess.
Comment?
Yes, Hank.
Aviation Week and Space Technology Magazine had an article not too long ago where they talked about metal shavings having been discovered.
Do you have any idea what might have caused the metal shavings?
Well, the article was vague, but it certainly made it sound like it was a machine tool marking because they were spherical in shape.
Okay. I wonder how many months, years, or decades it'll take before some guy writes a book and explains why they drilled a hole in their spacecraft.
Like I said, it wasn't specific, deliberately, as I read it. I mean, it was one of those articles that sort of didn't say what it was trying to say.
But one day, it was behind the bathroom facility. They drilled it right through it. And then they went out for an EVA. They wanted to go outside and take pictures of it. But just to get to it, they had to cut through this heavy insulation. You know, NASA would have a nice plan, and they'd do everything needed. They would cut through everything. This guy was out there with it looked like a sheetrock saw, and he's ripping through the insulation because he just get carried away. You know, the pieces flying all over, flying through space, very rough. It's a different world. I'm surprised we're still involved with them on the space station.
Well, we're kind of stuck being international out there, and no one wants to pull the plug entirely. I'm sure it benefits research. You know, microgravity environments are not that easy to get to, other than this. But you know, it's sort of like living in the same house as your ex after the divorce.
Oh, yeah. Well, we've got 20 countries involved with the space station. And, you know, they were all right for a while, you know, when they started it. But they, you know, it started back in, Reagan proposed it. They were going to call it the Freedom Space Station. It eventually just became the International Space Station. But, you know, look how many years ago that they got involved with this, you know, and... You know, countries change, politics change, and the only thing that we should have done is made sure we had something to launch from American soil, you know, long before we gave up the shuttle back in 2011.
I'm not quite sure what was the reasoning behind that. Was that a cost-benefit assessment, or just some silly administrator having a really bad decision day?
Comment, N1YDY.
Oh, it's cost. YDY is in there. Cost is, of course, the main thing. You need money to do this. If you don't get the allocation for that kind of money, you know, it's not going to happen.
Okay, so we saved the buck and we ended up paying a lot more. Yes, what did you want to say, Hank?
Essentially similar, but George W. Bush was on record as saying that he believed that the new program would be available much sooner than later. You know, they'd already updated all the flight deck electronics. They went from what was essentially a steam gauge type of set of flight instruments, and by that I mean literally gimbal gyros and all the rest of these things that had to be caged when they were in microgravity and then re-erected prior to full reentry. And they went from that to very modern, for the time, EFIS-type instruments, and then less than a year later decided to, or it was decided for them to retire the system. So it was a political decision as much as it was as an economic decision.
Hey, thanks a lot, Hank. And as we all know, political decisions always work out, right? Anyway, on to the next story. New research recently seems to show that human fetuses develop cells that disappear by the time they're born. And some of these muscles were last seen in our adult ancestors over 250 million years ago. The evolutionary journey of any species is littered with detours and dead ends. Humans, for instance, have vestigial body parts that once served a function but are effectively useless nowadays. The appendix is typically singled out as a vestigial organ, though a better example might be our wisdom teeth. Many animals also form body parts early in their development that largely or entirely fade away before birth, such as the tailbone in human beings. But according to the authors of this new study published in the journal Development, we haven't been able to track the formation of these temporary body parts in humans with any great detail. Using advanced 3D imaging techniques, the authors say, they were able to provide the clearest picture yet of our limbs' early growth, and it appears to be pretty weird. In the hand and foot of a 7-week-old fetus, for instance, they were able to find 30 individual muscles, but by week 13 of gestation, a third of the muscles had vanished or fused together. A pair of these atavistic muscles, as they're known, is called the dorsal metacarpalis. And though it's still found in many limbed animals today, including lizards and salamanders, it seems to have stopped appearing in our adult ancestors more than 250 million years ago. Let me drop for a sec. Look, what is fascinating is that we observe various muscles that have never been described in human prenatal development, and that some of these atavistic muscles were seen even in 11.5-week-old fetuses, which is strikingly late for developmental atavism. Study author Ruth Diogo, an evolutionary biologist at Howard University in Washington, D.C., said in a release by the study's publisher, these remnant organs and parts are a nifty illustration of how evolution works over a long period of time. While we may not need a tail anymore, our genomes still contain the blueprints for one. And they even can reappear if someone is born with a rare mutation or is exposed to something in the womb that damages their development. Though these muscles in particular wouldn't likely cause much harm if you were born with them, the authors say that their research reinforces that such variations and anomalies can be caused by the delayed or arrested development of a fetus in the womb. And perhaps more than anything, Diogo said, the findings provide a fascinating, powerful example of evolution at play. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS. Okay, on with the next. Electric motors guzzle electricity, which can be especially hard on rechargeable batteries. The power cells used in electric vehicles like Teslas have an expected lifespan of around 30,000 to 500,000 miles, but a team of battery researchers believes that it has come up with a recipe that can double that, leading to batteries that can potentially outlast the electric car itself. In a paper published in the Journal of Electrochemical Society earlier last month, battery researchers from Halifax, Nova Scotia, Dalhousie University describe a new lithium-ion battery that could potentially power an electric vehicle for over 1 million miles and over 4,000 charging cycles, while only losing about 10% of its charging capacity and vehicular range as it reaches the end of its lifespan. Most drivers upgrade their rides well before the odometer rolls over to 1 million. But the new battery technology could be especially useful in vehicles that are on the road against the clock, like taxis, shuttles, and even delivery trucks. Like the ingredients of a fast food chain's special sauce, the chemical makeup of batteries, which governs how well they perform and how long they last, are usually a closely guarded secret. Since 2016, the Dalhousie team has actually been conducting its research on improving lithium-ion batteries exclusively for Tesla. But this paper divulges exactly how they came up with a recipe for a million-mile electric battery by optimizing all of the ingredients, which includes artificial graphite, and then improving the nanostructure of the lithium nickel manganese cobalt oxide to create a crystal structure that's less likely to crack and degrade performance. The exact recipe allows all of Tesla's competitors to improve their battery tech. So what's going on? Let me drop for a sec. According to Wired, who spoke to former researchers who worked in the Dalhousie lab, by publishing the most important details of this research, it provides a new performance benchmark for all of the R&D labs working on improving battery technology. So ideally, a million miles of battery life is just the beginning. But Elon Musk is not one to simply give away valuable research without a backup plan. And as Wired points out, just days after the paper was published, Tesla was awarded a patent for a new electric battery featuring nearly the exact same chemical makeup as the one detailed in the research paper. One of the inventors listed in the new patent was physicist Jeff Dahn, who just so happens to lead the Dalhousie University's battery lab. The exact details of Tesla's newly patented lithium-ion battery aren't known, but former researchers who worked alongside Don believe there's a very good chance it already outperforms the battery detailed in the research paper. It's also unknown when Tesla would put the new battery into production, but there will undoubtedly be plenty of fanfare when Musk officially debuts into the world. Let me drop for a sec. As with any force of nature, when there is good news with Elon Musk attached, there will almost always follow not-so-good news. The National Highway Traffic Safety Administration is reviewing a petition asserting that Tesla should have recalled 2,000 Model S and Model X units after a battery safety update arrived in May. The automaker allegedly knew the car's batteries were defective and decided that it would rather push an update that reduced the range, performance, and charging speed than replace the batteries under warranty. The update has been prompted by a Model S bursting into flames in Hong Kong, although there have been multiple seemingly spontaneous fires over the past several years. Much as the lithium-ion battery in your mobile devices, there's a chance that overheating or charging issues could trigger a chemical reaction that sets the electronic vehicle's batteries ablaze. There's no certainty that the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration's review will lead to a formal investigation or a recall request. Nonetheless, the case illustrates the virtues and vices of over-the-air software updates for cars. They can mitigate or eliminate problems that previously would have required a dealership visit if one was even possible. How many cars can receive breakthrough performance tweaks through a patch? At the same time, there is a concern that car companies might use software to avoid dealing with deep-seated hardware issues. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS. Okay, for my last story for tonight, National Geographic reports that the InSight team released several new results at a joint meeting of the European Planetary Science Congress and the American Astronomical Society. These results include measurements of the Martian magnetic field and more evidence of liquid water beneath its surface. InSight launched and landed back in 2018 carrying three planetary science instruments as well as auxiliary instruments like a magnetometer, the first ever used on Mars. A team led by Christopher Russell at the University of California, Los Angeles, analyzed data from the magnetometer, finding that the InSight landing area has a strong magnetic field. That electric current travels through the ionized portion of the planet's atmosphere, and that occasionally the magnetic field pulses at night. These pulses can last up to 2 hours and are strongest in the north direction, according to the conference abstract. Pulses themselves aren't strange, according to the National Geographic report, but the fact that the pulses only happen near midnight is. Now, scientists don't yet have an explanation for the pulses, but they hope to use these instruments to understand the differences between the magnetic fields of Earth and Mars. More evidence of water on Mars is always exciting, given that the planet may have once harbored worldwide oceans. Scientists in this case use the magnetometer to find a deep conductive region below the Martian surface, according to National Geographic, but there's more research needed before conclusively identifying this region, and none of this data has yet been peer-reviewed. InSight has only been taking data for less than a year, and it just woke up from the solar conjunction. So there's still plenty more for the probe to discover and learn. Hopefully its heat probe can soon get unstuck. I think it did get unstuck. Paul, you probably know far better than I. Anyway, let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS.
A comment, Roy Antuio.
Okay, Rich.
Yes, I don't remember his name, but I read something on Yahoo News this evening, just before the tech that came on. A scientist who's been with NASA for years proposes that there is life on other planets. He said anywhere between 100,000 planets and forget how many, he said, in our Milky Way galaxy. Maybe Paul can elaborate on that, but it was a very interesting article. Back you are, boy, into wheel.
Okay, Rich, I was not aware of this particular story, but a lot of people play a lot of statistical games. They count up the number of estimated solar systems in the Milky Way galaxy and the probabilities of different conditions, and they pull a number out of their hat. And unfortunately, there's no way of proving or disproving any of this, but Paul, are you aware of this new prediction?
Oh, by the way, he said, sounds crazy, but he is with NASA, he's been with them as a scientist for years, it said. He said that we've been visited by aliens, in other words, intelligent life. Now, I'm just saying what I read. So back to you and turn it over to Paul. M2EO.
Hey, Richie, that only kind of leads me to ponder the possibility that maybe he stopped taking his medication or something. Unfortunately, you know, I did stories earlier tonight. The Army has come up with very, very strange ideas of walking through walls and staring at goats to kill them, and NASA has played games with Newton's third law of motion and come up with the M drive and now the helical engine that's probably fundamentally impossible. So I wouldn't be surprised if some guy who at one point worked for NASA started to talk to Little Green Men. Once again, I'll ask Paul if he has any idea about this guy.
No, not that late story, no. No, but there's, you know, in all occupations, you're going to have people that are going to, you know, favor one thing or another, you know. And you could be a scientist, you could be a politician, you could be, you know, a secretary, every teaches certain part of the population are not only going to believe that there's people that you know that we've been visited by aliens, but that they're here, you know, and they some of them have talked to them, you know. So you know, you could be an actor, astronaut, Mitchell. He flew on one of the Apollo missions. He said outright he definitely believes that there's aliens. Believed in ESP and all. He even did an ESP that he was, you know, test that he was flying through space and he did this test he wasn't supposed to do. All kinds of characters. When we see the proof, we'll, you know, we'll be the first ones to listen to it and report it back to you.
Roy, that magnetic field pulses on Mars. Although InSight spacecraft detected them, I suspect they're a hell of a lot weaker than the magnetic field on Earth. Is it true? ACGS, KGIW.
I haven't seen any definitive numbers, but that would be my guesstimate as well. These are not kind of the robust magnetic fields that we're used to here.
I think everything we know about Mars leads us to believe it's a pretty hostile place. Cold, airless, magnetic field, no. Cosmic rays, solar winds, all kinds of things that are lethal to human beings. Further evidence that I'm convinced that our grandchildren are not going to see human beings standing on Mars. Over to you, Roy. K2RIW.
I would tend to agree. I think they're going to be robotic missions. They'll be very interesting. I find it hard to believe that human beings at our present level of technology, I mean, who knows, maybe 20 years from now, propulsion will have a revolutionary new discovery and other sciences. But right now, looking at the projection of what we're capable of, and the mess that is trying to live on Mars, I don't know. It strikes me as pretty much suicidal.
I'm amazed that people will volunteer to go on such a mission if Musk does create the hardware that's capable of going there. But to colonize Mars is out of the question. It has to be self-sustaining to colonize. And how in the world do you grow food in that environment? Very difficult. Over to you, Roy.
I think for Elon Musk, this mission is his spruce goose.
WS2N on the InSight mission.
Paul.
Yeah, Roy, I was going to bring up InSight there, and you asked about the mole, whether or not that cleared itself. Yeah, that thing went down.